We're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, nature, and outdoor recreation today. This is Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. In the studio with me is Tim Isley. He's a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Hey, Tim, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Jill. Great to be here.
And on the phone, we have Dean Bortz, the editor of the Wisconsin Outdoor News. You with us, Dean?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being with us. And we also have Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communications Association. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Jill. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. I'm glad we were able to get in contact with you. Sorry for the little mix-up on that.
No problem.
Okay, great. We have lots to talk about today, and we'd like you to join the conversation. So give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. We love to see your nature photos, so you can post them there. Gentlemen, fall in Wisconsin means hunting to a lot of people. So why don't we start there? The legislature recently eliminated the use of carcass tags for deer, goose, and deer hunting. Why was that change made? Pat, why don't you start with that?
Well, as far as why, it's always hard to know, because in this case, Representative Joel Clefish, who was the man behind the change, didn't really let us know why it was going on, for one thing.
Oh.
And we learned the why as things unfolded. But his point mm-hmm. was that it was such a mess last year with where people were printing off their own tags, and then they're using regular old printer paper out of their homes, and then having to take special care out in the field to make sure they could properly attach it. And there was a lot of confusion, and I could understand his frustration with it. And then by the time it went through the legislative, it's always an interesting process going in, putting anything through the legislature.
Yes.
Once it went through the legislature and got passed, we're already into the hunting season instead of, back in the summer when the budget would usually be passed. So we had, once again, a lot of controversy around something that really shouldn't have been all that controversial.
Mm. So what does that actually mean for the hunter out in the woods?
The one thing that does not change is that you still have to register your deer. You can't, in the past, for I think this, according to the information I have, is that starting in 1901, we actually started requiring hunters to put a physical tag on their deer when they killed it. And we also had the same requirement for turkey hunting and for goose hunting. And that would show our conservation warden right on the spot that, this bird has been legally harvested and tagged. And well, now we don't have that quick eyesight affirmation, but you still have to phone it in, get a confirmation number, and keep track of the confirmation number so you can show a warden in any kind of field check that you did register the animal.
Okay. Dean, what do you think about this change? Okay,
well,
don't take the whole show, but
Well, okay, there's different levels of questions, frustrations, and everything with this change. Overall, is it going to impact hunting and the counting of deer? I guess that I would say maybe not, but that really remains to be seen how people react to this. I guess my thought on not just this change, but a number of changes that we've made in our deer registration and tagging system is that we used to put a lot of, when I say we, I mean hunters and the DNR, used to put a lot of emphasis on tracking our kills, counting deer, counting bear, whatever it might be, so that we'd have a solid basis of information to start with when we start looking at population estimates and stuff. And I think hunters felt like they were an important part of that. And when we started making it, where you don't have to go to a registration station to check in your deer, where you can do it by phone. And then last year we had paper tags instead of the everybody calls it Tyvek, but it's not a Tyvek tag that we used to have. There's a different term for it, but we had a substantial tag. that would not tear, rip, or get wet. Mm-hmm. And I think when that started changing, hunters got the impression like, huh, well, this isn't really that big of a deal anymore. So maybe, you know, it doesn't matter, or, you know, we're not going to do it. If the DNR doesn't care, I don't care. I think you started seeing a little bit of that last year, and I'm afraid we're going to see more of that this year. So I think that's probably one of the biggest impacts we may end up seeing out of this, is that hunters just are going to say, well, if the DNR doesn't care, of course, the DNR did not make this change. The legislature did, so really it's the legislature that they should blame.
Okay. Tim, you're shaking your head. What do you say?
Well, yeah, thanks, Jill. I definitely agree. I think there's two points here. One is that this was all that came about because of the legislature. And the problem is that when we've got the legislature making these rules, you're not getting, and sometimes there aren't the hearings. They just put it in the budget bill, and they put it in late. And unfortunately, rather than going through the process that we have of using the Conservation Congress, using the Department of Natural Resources, you get these things that are sort of surprises, and maybe there are going to be some negative things afterwards, and we don't know about that. Maybe there'll be some positive things. But the problem is some of these things with natural resources, they're coming through the legislature, and I really don't think that's where this should start. The second thing is, I was up at the Natural Resources Board meeting this morning. The board, their monthly meeting is here in Madison, and they're meeting uptown at the DNR building. And there were some changes made to the Go Wild system that they're going to be making coming up this year. But one of the questions came up to Todd Schaller, who's the chief warden, conservation warden here in the state of Wisconsin. And Todd was asked to make a few comments before the board. And one of the comments he made this morning, which I thought was interesting, he said, because there is this unsure, you know, people doing away with the carcass tags, people don't know exactly what they're going to do. He said, if people do what they did last year, they're going to be fine. So people who have the carcass tags, they've already got them, they bought their licenses, you know, if they want to attach it to a deer or they carry it with them, no matter what they do, if they do what they did last year, basically, which is registering the animal, calling in and registering, the only change is with the Canada goose. Before, we used to call in, and we had to call in if we harvested a Canada goose. And now you no longer have to do that. And so they believe that the DNR, through its surveys afterwards, the small game surveys, that they'll pick up the Canada goose harvest. That I think that's an open question. I mean, before, when you harvested a Canada goose and you called it in, they knew exactly how many Canada geese were harvested. Mm-hmm. So now they're going to have to do that with surveys. And I think that's, right now, there's some question about that.
Okay. Well, and last year, the hunters didn't have to wear the tags on the back. How did that work out for, all you gentlemen hunt? How did that work? Have you heard anything? I mean, Tim, go ahead.
I haven't heard anything, and I don't know how many tickets they would have given for violations. I mean, they didn't have to wear the back tag, so where that would have entered in is, again, somebody illegally trespassing on property or doing something, and if somebody wanted to report a back tag, that they couldn't have done it. So I really haven't heard of any problems, but I haven't heard. How about the other guys?
Dean, Patrick, either one of you?
Well, actually, Dean and I have long disagreed on the back tag issue.
Okay. All right, Pat. Well, let's hear your side.
I'm going to let him go first, so I can cut his legs off.
There you go.
I've always contended that, you know, for going back probably about 20 years, that we do not need back tags. Deer hunters do not need back tags. That Wisconsin was one of the rare states that still required hunters to wear back tags. And I always thought, well, if we don't require every other outdoor recreationist, whether they're mushroom hunting or paddle boarding or whatever it might be, to wear back tags, why do you make deer hunters do it? Are we somehow not to be less trusted than our folks? So I've always opposed back tags, and I was really happy when we got rid of them. It's just one less thing to mess around with.
Okay, Dean, what do you think?
Pat and I both hunt out west quite a bit, and I don't think there's any state that either he or I hunt in where back tags are required. So I've hunted without back tags in a number of states, and you know, there's really no problem not having them. The thing that I liked about the back tags, and this is going to be a little bit of a circle discussion here, and one-way discussion, I suppose, because I'm doing it. But if we go back to when Governor Walker hired Dr. James Kroll to come in to look at our deer management program. One of the things we heard a lot about was, hey, let's put fun back into deer hunting. And I guess I would argue that since then we've taken more fun out of it than we've added to it. But part of the fun for me was having a back tag. It wasn't that big of a problem to have it on. We had, and I guess it's, and this is just going to be for a small group of people, not all deer hunters, because we used to have a reserve back tag system, and we still do have it. It's still lingering within our computer system, but you could keep the same number year to year if you paid an extra fee, and you could request a number if it was available. And I had number 52, which I had gotten from my friend Jim Michaels when he found out he had terminal cancer, and he had gotten that number from Bill Burke, who used to be involved in the Nina Foundry. Maybe Bill was the owner or something like that. I don't remember. But Bill and Jim were friends, and Bill got the tag, or Jim got the tag transferred to him from Bill when Bill found out that he was going to pass away. Jim passed it on to me when he found out he was terminal, and asked me to hold on to the numbers, that if any of his kids ever moved home from Illinois or grandkids, then I could transfer the tag to, or that back tag number to them. And so I paid, you know, in what, $5 or $10 a year to have that number.
So
and a number of other people did too. So that's gone now.
What I'm hearing from kind of all three of you is that there's so much tradition involved in deer hunting that some of these new things seem to be taking away, and the camaraderie, the tradition. Is that right?
I think I definitely agree with you, because I think the back tag, which Dean just alluded to, also the registration stations. You used to take the deer in, or the turkeys, and you'd go into the registration station. And I know I talked to somebody who has got a registration station over in Crawford County, and it used to be like an old home week. You know, the hunters would be standing around, they'd be talking about what they saw in the woods. Obviously, it was good for the store. They were selling, you know, hamburgers and sodas and things like that. But people met there, and it's some of that tradition that we now are losing. Yeah, good point.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phone, because we have Dennis in Clintonville who has a comment on this. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. As far as the carcass tags, I still wear my back tag. I'm bullheaded that way. But the carcass tags, the majority of good ethical hunters are still going to register deer, even though they don't have to tag it. To me, it's just making it easier for the poachers and the slob hunters to violate, and ultimately it's going to hurt the resource, I think.
Okay, well, thanks for those comments, Dennis. We're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, nature, and outdoor recreation with our guests today. They are Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. We'd like to hear from you, too, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, nature, and outdoor recreation. Do you have a question or comment? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we were just talking about carcass tagging and other things in that nature. So we've got a comment from Jerry in Eau Claire. So let's go to him. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, are you with us?
This is Jerry Powers from Eau Claire.
Uh-huh.
And I started hunting when I was 12 years old. And today, of course, I'm 75 years old. And I hunted back and forth between the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin. So I know about back tags and no back tags. And one of the things that they don't bring up is, how do you turn in a violator safely? Ask him to pose for a picture. And take a picture, and I'm not going to take a picture of a man holding a gun. And what about the deer hunters in Rice Lake, where the number, the back tag number, was engraved in the dirt on the four-wheeler? That seemed to work very well. I don't understand what's going on to the system. We used to have metal tags. We used to go in and get a second metal tag, and you felt safe, and you were registered. You didn't have a 72-hour law Now we have a 72-hour law, and I don't understand that, where you must, if you have a deer in chronic waste, you must get it into a taxidermy, or you must get it into a processor or into a station to get it tested.
Okay, well, thanks, Jerry. Dean, what do you think about Jerry's comments?
Well, he covered a lot of ground there.
Yes.
Let's start with the CWD comments. Let's see. Pat, you know this topic better than I do, but I'm thinking that you are not required to get your deer tested if you don't wish to. So if Jerry was talking about the inconvenience of having a deer tested, I don't think you have to have one tested. Now, I would want to have one tested if I shot one in an area that could potentially have CWD in it. I'd want to have it tested, but I don't think you have to have a deer tested. Is that right, Pat?
That's correct. In fact, people like me are who always wanted to be king. We would require it to be mandatory testing in this state, but it's not required.
And Pat, you had mentioned something earlier about Wisconsin oldest sausage makers deciding to no longer accept venison. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because that kind of relates.
I worked on an article about a month ago. I think it's called, it's a big sausage making company out of Oshkosh, Silver Creek Specialty, I think they're called. And they've been, they own several brands that go back into the 1940s with sausage making. And they decided, after looking at how far CWD has now spread in Wisconsin, how prevalent it is, and how few people are getting their deer tested, they decided to quit making venison sausage for hunters. And the reason they got into this, or the reason they got out of it, is because they're a major processor of sausage. So what they would do, for efficiency's sake, because they have such large equipment, is they would take the hunter's venison and, multiple hunters at a time, take those packages from many different people and mix it all together, and then run it through their grinders and mix it with other meat from other hunters, and eventually it'd come out sausage. And you never know that way if you're getting your own meat back or someone else's meat. And they just decided this is getting too complicated. We're getting too many things coming in here. We don't want to be at risk ourselves. And if there's a problem with CWD popping up, in someone else's meat, they don't want to be responsible for it. And so, I think what's happening then is that I'm sure more hunters, as they become aware of this, what's called batch processing, where you take multiple hunters' meat scraps and turn them into sausage, they'll probably start looking for more sausage makers, sausage processors who guarantee you get your own meat back, rather than take the risk of having tainted meat get into your venison. So that was a tough decision for them, because basically they're walking away. Their estimate was they're walking away from about $300,000 a year in sausage processing by cutting out the venison, wild venison alternatives.
So, Tim, what does that actually mean? The chronic wasting disease obviously has been around for a while. What's the status of it right now?
Well, it seems to be increasing in new areas. It's been cropping up in new areas, and especially they seem to be finding it on some of the deer farms. There are just a couple of new instances within the past week, I believe. So where it is, it seems to be getting larger and larger, more prevalent, and it seems to be growing out to some of those outlying counties. As a deer hunter, I definitely will have any venison tested for chronic wasting disease, and I would think it's important for a hunter to have it tested. So I definitely think that's good. Jerry's comments also about the back tags I thought were interesting, because as a private landowner, when you have the deer season going on and you have 600,000 deer hunters out during that 1 week period of the 9 day season, as a private landowner, if you do have problems, having that back tag is one way that you can report somebody to get some help. You have to call into the sheriff. And that is one way to identify people. And I agree with Jerry on that. That was one benefit of having back tags. And I certainly think as a private landowner, that was, I didn't mind wearing a back tag. People who are ethical, you know, what's the difference having a back tag on or not having a back tag? But having a back tag on, I think maybe somebody might mind their P's and Q's a little bit closely.
That's probably why it came about in the first place, maybe? Okay. All right, well, let's go back to the phone. We have Mark in Superior with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. What's on your mind?
Okay, so I'm a new hunter. I started deer hunting last year. I recently moved to Wisconsin. And so last year I found out that if you need to do a field day for a hunting license or for your hunter safety, pretty much nobody in Wisconsin does it basically the month before rifle opener. So I found a DNR loophole last year where if you do the Minnesota online course, they do not require you to do a field day, and Wisconsin will accept that to hunt in Wisconsin. So will Wisconsin ever go to an online-only system?
Okay. Who wants to take that, Dean or Pat?
Sure, I can jump in on that.
Okay.
I think the answer is we really don't know, but I can take a guess at what the responses would be. I mean, we have the Wisconsin has a hunter education group, you know, a group of volunteers who have an association, and they work with the DNR on improving, changing, updating class curriculum and what we're going to include in the program and what we're not. I don't know if the caller's completely accurate in saying that there's not anybody in the state offering a field day the month prior to gun deer season. There probably is somewhere, but it wouldn't necessarily be convenient if you're living in Superior or vice versa if you're living in Madison and it's up in Superior. So, yeah, the you know, the online course is handy, but then getting in the requirement of the field day can be kind of clumsy and difficult. And the caller is right in that a lot of the classes are held in spring, summer, and that's when the field days would also take place. Would we ever go to a system that doesn't require a field day? I would think most of our volunteer instructors would be opposed to that. I know that they feel that they need to get our new hunters out in the field, give them some actual experiences and hands-on learning situations. So that'd be my thought, is that we'd probably not go to it or not go to it very quickly.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for bringing up that question, Mark. Let's go next to Sue in Mequon. Hi, Sue. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is about CWD. I'm not a hunter. I haven't had an opportunity to eat venison for many years, but I can't imagine that I would eat any venison if it wasn't tested. So I was wondering, how much does it cost to test? Does it delay you having access to your processing? And do all three of our guests test theirs?
Okay, well, Tim, I think you said you did, right?
I would definitely have it tested, and I think no matter if it's $10 or if it's $50, I'd pay it. To me, it's worth it to have it done. So the problem sometimes is finding places to test it, and like in some counties, there's only one person who might be doing the testing. In the county where I hunt, there is a gentleman who does taxidermy who has volunteered to do that. But then you have to take it down to him, and so there's a little bit of a rigmarole on that as far as getting it in. But I would definitely have it tested, and to me, if it's $50, it's worth it.
What about you, Pat?
Well, yeah, we should know it costs nothing right now to get your deer tested.
Okay.
You know, it's all covered by the hunting license fees, so that part's covered. I always get my deer tested. I hunt a lot. I do most of my hunting in gun season, the opening weekend in the late season, down in Richland County, which is we're expecting to find CWD one of these years on my late uncle's farm down there. It's been spreading up that way, and it's been found around us, but never quite in the block we're in. So we're expecting it to show up. You know, personally, I don't eat it until I don't eat the venison until I get the test back. You know, and I've always been lucky. I've never had a deer yet show up positive. And the question, though, like comes up in our family quite often is that, you know, I'm 61 now. I have 4 grandkids, and we've always shared our venison products with our kids, and it's something we all love venison. We all love the products. And the thing that we're now confronting, too, is that, well, if these processors are not asking hunters where they get their venison, where they got their deer, and there's really not much testing going on. I think the numbers I ran last fall showed that only about 10% of the deer being killed in these.
Oop, I think we might have just lost Pat. Pat, are you still there? Oh, I guess not. Okay, well, Dean, did you want to finish up on that at all? Oh, we lost Dean, too, so I think we're having problems with our phone, Tim. We might have a two-way conversation. Okay. Well, you know, let's just chat. You just said that you were at the Natural Resources Board meeting this morning, and thank you for leaving there a little bit early. What were some of your takeaways from that?
Well, it's really interesting. Well, one of the things is that I was hoping to hear from the new secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, Daniel Meyer.
Right.
And he was not at the meeting.
Oh.
So it was interesting. So this is the second meeting that has been held since he's been appointed as secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. The first one, he was just newly appointed. But evidently, they announced that he was up north with the governor. So there's some appointment, announcement going on up north. But it is sort of interesting that now, when our secretaries are appointed by the governor, beforehand, Kathy Stepp, who had been the secretary, she had missed several of the board meetings because of other things. Years ago, back in the 1970s and 80s, when the secretary was appointed by the board, the secretary was always there at the board meetings. But now the secretary is there with the governor, and that was a noticeable difference. There were several things that came up today that were on the agenda. One, they had at the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest up in northern Wisconsin, there are some proposals there to open up some of the areas to some off-road, some of the ATVs, UTVs. And it was interesting to hear the discussion, and they voted to approve that. They there was an amendment to open it up during the firearm deer season, which could go through into December on some of these things for the ATVs and UTVs. And then also they decided to take the Big Lake campground out of, they were going to be modernizing that, and they decided to not do that because there were people who had objected to that. But watching the board is so interesting because these are citizens, they're appointed by the governor, but they discuss, and they're from all parts of the state, seven citizens who serve at no cost, no salary. And so they discuss these things, and they go around and they take in public input. And I think the board system is really good. It's one of the solid things that we have here in Wisconsin. I've had it since 1927, when the Conservation Department, the Conservation Commission, originally was founded, and continuing with that board system, it was really very interesting. So there's going to be some other presentations coming up on ginseng that I think will be interesting, that I'm going to have to catch up on. They also, with the new wild system with the card, now with this wild system, when you get your license, you can get a plastic card, and there's different things rather than having a printed out license, and they're updating that so that they're going to have some more things that will be active. The records will be kept on the wild system, so they gave a progress report on that. And so it was interesting, the little bit that I was able to be there.
And what powers do the board have?
Basically, the board sets the policies for the Department of Natural Resources. So they set policy, and then they approve regulations. So when the regulations come up, whether it be the hunting regulations, environmental regulations, they go before the board. So they go before the citizen board. And so they get to approve those things, and then basically they go to the governor for final approval. But that's where a lot of the public input, and so these will come before the board, and then the citizens also have a chance. They have a public appearance part of the board meeting. So Joe Smith and Sally Jones can come before the board and give their opinions and have their say, which is really good. So they approve the regulations, and they also set the policy, sort of the guidance, the long range for the Department of Natural Resources. And, of course, in the past, they used to hire the secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. And that changed during Tommy Thompson's term in about 1994 or so, and where the governor now appoints the secretary, which just having the citizen board appoint the secretary just keeps it at arm's length from direct politics. You've always got politics involved, and people were appointed by different governors, you know, the Republicans, Democrats, the whole bit. But they came together And they did that and looked at the long-term natural resources. And so it was really a good system. Keeping that citizen board, I think, is really important.
Now, when the secretaries were chosen by the board, did they tend to have a little bit more of a natural resources background or not necessarily?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The very first one was George Meyer, who had been an attorney with the Department of Natural Resources, came up through the DNR. And when Tommy Thompson made that change, appointment by the governor, he kept George Meyer. But after that, there were different secretaries, and every time, different governors, and every time the secretary has changed, and it has never been somebody who came up from within the Department of Natural Resources. Previously, you would have people in fisheries or in forestry or environmental who came up and had an environmental background. Like Kathy Stepp, our past secretary, she was a home builder involved down in southeast Wisconsin. The current secretary, Dan Meyer, he was a legislator from up north. He was involved with the Chamber of Commerce. So the other one was a lawyer, Matt Frank, didn't have a natural resources background. So we lose getting people with professional experience in natural resources, and that's one of the losses with having the governor appointed.
Okay, and we are still having problems with our phone, so I'm really sorry our other two people aren't on with us, but we're fixing them up. So we do have a question from Dave from Fort Atkinson, though. He says he's seeing more deer carcasses along the roadside, and they don't appear to be getting picked up. He wants to know why this is. Is it a change of policy at DNR, or is it due to budget cutbacks? What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I've seen a lot more deer carcasses along the roadways, but I think a lot of it, they changed years ago, and I'm not exactly up to date on it, but I think that the counties or the local townships now are responsible for picking up the deer, and I think there used to be a way of paying them, and I think they still get some payments. But I don't know that budget cutbacks have been responsible for that. I think they're just more and more deer, and I think maybe the local towns and the counties just haven't got the manpower to pick it up as regularly as they used to do.
Right, and I think we did have a question on that a few months back, and I believe that is the correct, it goes to the county.
Okay.
And we did have a call from Michael from Elroy. He wants to know about the state of the ruffed grouse population around where he lives. He grew up hunting them, but says they're now gone. Are there efforts to reintroduce them in Wisconsin? And we get a question all the time about those ruffed grouse. Are they?
Those wily ruffed grouse.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful game bird.
Okay.
One of the four native species of grouse in the state of Wisconsin. It's a wonderful bird, and I sympathize with what Michael has to say about ruffed grouse. Ruffed grouse normally have gone on about a 10-year cycle. It's sort of like a roller coaster between ups, peaks, and valleys. And so in some recent years were supposed to be up towards the peaks, and this year they're expecting to have a fairly good year. But from what I'm hearing from a lot of people who have been hunting up north, they're not seeing the grouse that they expected to see. And so it is a big disappointment, although I was just talking on the phone just in fact yesterday with a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service up around Park Falls, and he was saying that a lot of hunters were coming in also saying that they weren't seeing the ruffed grouse, but they were hunting some of the traditional places, some of the aspen, which is usually what ruffed grouse like. And he was advising to go into some of these other areas that for some reason, because maybe of the warm weather, we've had such a warm summer and
it's
a warm fall.
Yes.
It's really
mm-hmm.
unusual. So that, yeah, they've changed a little bit. But the what I'm hearing from people is that they aren't seeing the ruffed grouse that they've had. As far as bringing ruffed grouse into the state, that isn't something that we've really tried. We did it with wild turkeys. We traded ruffed grouse to Missouri for wild turkeys, and it's been a tremendous success. And ruffed grouse really are, it depends on habitat. Scott Walter, who now is with the Ruffed Grouse Society and used to be the upland wildlife biologist for the Department of Natural Resources, has studied ruffed grouse. And he actually put radio transmitters on ruffed grouse in Richland County and then studied them and their movements. You know, and some people think that it's predators, and it's really easy to blame predators. Yeah, they take some ruffed grouse. They're really good to eat. It's like meatloaf sandwich. You know, everybody loves it. You love it. But the problem is habitat in the woods, and we're not harvesting the woods and making the young successional forest. As a private landowner, you know, you brought up, you think, oh, I shouldn't cut those trees. Well, especially with some trees, aspen, And some trees do need to be cut to regenerate them to get young forests. Also, oaks in the southern part of the state. Oaks are so important for rough grouse, oaks and hickories. You have those, you have a food plot for a lifetime. So the important thing is private landowners getting out on the land and managing for some of these things, and managing for oaks and hickories, and up north for doing some of these cuts for to try and regenerate aspen. Organizations such as the Rough Grouse Society, they emphasize habitat, and that is the key. So I think if you were to bring rough grouse in, I just am not a biologist, so I can't say 100%, but I don't think it would do any good. I think what you need to do is manage habitat. And so what they would do up there around Elroy would be getting some of the private landowners, some of the townships, trying to get them to manage some land for rough grouse. But it's a really good comment, and it's a wonderful game bird. When you're walking through a woods and a grouse takes off, it just puts the hair up on the back of your neck. It scares you half to death.
Oh, sure. It's a great sound. So if he's interested in maybe doing something for in his property, where does he go?
Really good question. So there'd be a couple places, but number one, the Rough Grouse Society, which is a conservation organization. Scott Walter is over in Richland County, and he is he's the biologist for, in fact, he does habitat biology for the entire United States. They've hired somebody now up in Spooner, Wisconsin. They have a biologist who's working up in northwest Wisconsin. They're going to be hiring somebody over in northeast Wisconsin. I would have that person contact Scott Walter in Richland County to get some suggestions. Also, go to the local Department of Natural Resources. Go to the DNR forester and the DNR wildlife manager. Get them out on the property. Have them take a look at the property and give you some advice. So those are some places you go. And the NRCS agent for the county. Those are places I'd go.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information, because I'm sure some people were definitely interested in that. We're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, nature, and outdoor recreation with our guest today. In the studio with me is Tim Isley. He's a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer, and hopefully we'll get back Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, and Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. I believe our phones are, well, they're working on them, but you can try giving us a call, 1-800-642-1234, and please send us an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today. We're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, and hopefully we've got our other two guests online. Dean, are you with us? Oh, and we can't hear him. Pat?
Yep, I'm back.
We got Pat, so we don't have Dean.
I heard Dean.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, Dean's here. Okay, I think we're good. Yay!
Woo-hoo.
All of you back. So,
kind of feeling kind of lost there.
Yeah. Well, we were lost without you, but Tim did a great job of filling in for you. So we're good to go, and we can take calls again. So please, if you have any questions or comments, go ahead and try calling in. It's 800-642-1234. And Tim, before this all happened here, we were going to talk to you about a recent ruling in federal court that involved duck hunting limits. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think what you're referring to, Jill, is that there were three duck hunting guides who guided over on the Mississippi River several years ago, and they were recently in federal court because they were charged with violating the Lacey Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And what happened is that these hunters had evidently allowed these guides had allowed waterfowl hunters to exceed their bag limit and do group bagging. And so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had been hearing about that. And the guides, in order to guide on the Upper Mississippi Federal Refuge, they have to get a permit because they're using that to make money, to make a livelihood.
Right.
So they have to apply and they get this permit. So they're out there, and they also have to get a guide permit from the Department of Natural Resources. And in both of those instances, they are asked to abide and to say that agree that they will abide by the regulations. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had been hearing that there were some guides that were allowing hunters to exceed the bag limits and do group bagging. So they had undercover special agents go out with these guides several years ago in 2012 and 2013, and they were with them, and they documented that these special agents were able to exceed their bag limit. And there was group bagging going on, and they were like, there's only one hen mallard that you can shoot per day, while they were shooting several hen mallards. So these were saying, so then they received violation notices, and they were brought into federal court. They were indicted. And so they came into federal court. So just this last summer, And in fact, last week, the last guide was in federal court here in Madison, so I was in those. And they all received the same fines. They had plea bargains. They were fined $25,000, and they were banned from the Upper Mississippi National Fish and Wildlife Refuge for 2 years. They can't hunt, they can't guide, they can't fish on the refuge there in the Mississippi River. So, and it sounds like it's fairly steep. On the other hand, they could have been fined $100,000, and they could have been put in prison for a year. So really, in some ways, it's a slap on the wrist, because these guys can go out and guide in other places in Wisconsin, they can guide in other states. I think it's a good reminder to hunters. Number one, I mean, the regulations are important. They're set there for a reason. They've got biologists that set these seasons, and it is really important. Number two, the bag limit is an individual bag limit. If I go out and I have a 6-duck bag limit, I can shoot 6 ducks. But if I'm out with you and you've only got 1 duck, I can't then shoot 7 and 8 ducks. That's my bag limit. When I reach my bag limit, I finish. That's the way it is. That's being an ethical hunter. So I think it's just reason to remind hunters and outdoorsmen. I mean, the future of hunting all depends on ethics, how we behave, and especially in view of the non-hunters, who are the majority of the population. So I think that's really important. So these were good examples and reminders to hunters. Number one, there is no group bagging. Number two, these regulations are there for a reason, and we need to obey them. We need to pay attention to them.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Pat, you know, you wanted to talk a little bit about a new organization called Green Fire. Can you tell us what it is and why was it formed?
This is basically a reaction of sorts. Green Fire is a group of retired Wisconsin DNR biologists, also retired university professors, who are basically their backgrounds are fish and wildlife management and the sciences of fish and wildlife. And they came into existence in this past year because the current administration has made it very difficult for DNR biologists and wildlife specialists, fishery specialists, to testify in the legislature and make public statements, even talk to the media sometimes. So these retirees were frustrated with this lack of scientific knowledge being shared publicly, you know, either in our legislature and in the newspapers. So they've organized, I think they have somewhere over 100 members now. We're basically making it known that if people want information on these different issues, there's this good pool of experts we can tap into and talk about it. And so to me, it's admirable that these folks are doing this, but at the same time, you still have to feel a little bit of anger and frustration that it's come to this point in our democracy where we're not getting this kind of free flow of information from our agencies, the agencies who are entrusted with our public resources, to manage our public resources for the public good. So it's like I say, I'm really proud of the fact these people are offering this expertise of theirs. But at the same time, I think it's really shameful that our state has to kind of resort to these, where we cobble together organizations to make up for a systematic attempt to shut down communication from our state wildlife agency.
How do you feel about that, Dean?
I think Pat's right. We had Green Fire, some representatives from Green Fire came to speak to the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association annual meeting in Eagle River earlier this year. And they see a need. And like Pat said, unfortunately, there is that need because right now, the DNR does not allow any of their scientists to testify at a legislative hearing on any kind of a bill. You know, it might be a hunting bill, it might be a water bill, it might be an air bill. You know, we have all this expertise within the agency, and these are the people who are currently working on those projects and are familiar with them, but they're not allowed to testify. Now, in the past, they had been. In the past, if Tim, Pat, or I covered a legislative hearing, you'd expect and not be surprised at all to see Tom Haughey talking about deer numbers or bear or elk or whatever it might be. I mean, they brought the DNR people in to talk about this stuff. That's not happening, and now, and in light of that, the green fire, the folks who are making up green fire now, like Pat said, the retired scientists, biologists, they say, look, if we can't get the guys and gals who are working today, you know, we just retired. We know what's going on there. We can testify. We've got the background. We still are active. And so they're trying to fill a gap here, and hopefully it'll provide some more information to legislators, and we won't have carcass tags coming up in the, you know, no need for carcass tags coming up in the middle of the hunting season when people have already started hunting with carcass tags.
Tim, you wanted to break in?
Sure. I agree. The Green Fire, I went to their meeting, their first organizational board meeting. It was September the 9th up at the Aldo Leopold Foundation in Baraboo. And it was very interesting because they had started, I think, back in April. They put out an announcement. People saw a need for exactly what Dean and Pat are talking about, and they came together. And it was interesting being up there, Jill, at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. I mean, it was a wonderful place to have this organizational meeting at Mecca, right here
in
Wisconsin. And so all these people, I mean, they added up the years of expertise that they had, who've been, you know, in wildlife and fisheries and environmental. A gentleman, Bob Martini, from up in Rhinelander, who knows water regulations and talked about how the Wisconsin River has improved when they put in these regulations to eliminate pollution, and it improved. It was better for business. It was better for the environment. So they've got the expertise, and I think they'd like to be looked at as the experts. So if the legislature wants somebody to give an opinion, or even an organization wants to say, hey, what about a certain proposal in the legislature coming up, they can go to this organization and get their expertise, because they've got a lot of expertise in a lot of different areas. I think it's a great organization, and it's needed, and I'm really pleased it's here.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks for that update. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Peter in Waupaca that wants to weigh in. Hi, Peter.
Hello. This question's for Pat Durgin. It seems that the deer hunters, the DNR, and Scott Walker think that if you pretend that there's no CWD, that it'll go away. Do you have any predictions on the path of our potential pandemic and how long it's going to take?
I would just be guessing at this if I were to say how fast this disease will progress. I mean, it's progressed pretty far already in the last 16 years, and it's only getting worse. And you know, you look at the numbers, the sheer numbers of CWD positive deer showing up, even with the rollbacks and testing that we're doing, we're still getting record numbers of sick deer showing up in these tests. And you know, I keep going, I guess as I get older, I keep thinking about the fact that I am getting closer to the end now. And I don't think we're going to see the end of deer hunting in what's left of my lifetime. But I really have to wonder if the next generation behind me will have these kind of great deer hunting traditions and stories to carry on themselves and to pass along to their kids. You know, we've been really been lucky in my lifetime to see the growth of the deer herd through the 1970s and 80s and into the 90s, where we have real problems caused by abundance now by deer. But the way the CWD is going in this herd, and we'll be seeing, there's no doubt in my mind, based on what we're seeing in Wyoming and parts of Colorado, that we're going to start seeing population impacts, where the population will start dropping. And we will see declines in hunting, deer hunting, because the fact is, when you're out there hunting in an area where every other deer running past you, every other buck running past you is already sick with CWD based on what we're seeing right now in parts of Iowa County, how many folks want to hunt a population that's carrying that kind of infection rate? So to me, even if we can show without any doubt that CWD will never cause human illness, who still wants to deal with a deer that's sick to that degree where you can't eat their, where you don't feel safe eating their meat? And I just think, I hate to sound like all gloom and doom, but I think the way we've squandered what little opportunity we had to control this disease the last 15 years, I'm pessimistic at anything we're seeing from the current administration will reverse that. I just don't see the will, I don't see the determination to even get in front of this issue at all.
So I could get in my soapbox and talk all day about this, but it is, I share Peter's concern. I really am deeply disappointed in how little the current administration is, how seriously they take this disease. They just don't seem to be too worried about it.
And Pat, you know, we've only got a few, less than a minute before we have to break for news, but are there any places in the U.S. that are controlling chronic wasting?
The only one that's had, you know, some success is parts of Northern Illinois. They've had the disease down there as long as we've had it in Wisconsin, and they've been able to keep the disease rates down around 1% to 2%. Pretty much we're at the level they found it years ago by keeping a real tight control on the harvest. They're shooting a lot of deer down there, and it's not quite the same habitat as we find in Wisconsin. It's more open habitat, more open woodlands and stuff. But it's a concerted effort they've been making to control it.
Okay,
and we haven't done that.
Okay, thanks, Pat, very much for that update. We've been talking about Wisconsin wildlife, nature, and outdoor recreation with our guests today, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after this news update, so stay with us. Talking of wildlife and nature in Wisconsin today. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry today. We're having a little roundtable discussion with our guest, Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, and Tim Isley, a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. What questions or concerns do you have about nature and wildlife in Wisconsin? Let us know by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, and you can post your comments and questions on our Facebook page too. Now we are going to go right to the phones, gentlemen, because we have Mike in Price County who has been extremely patient. Hi, Mike. What's your comment?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
It is a comment regarding the electronic registration. I'm affiliated with a local bar and eatery, and since the electronic registration has come into play, the business during gun season, deer gun season in particular, has dropped off significantly. I don't believe these legislators in Madison understand the impact that it has on local communities, especially up here in northern Wisconsin, where we depend on the hunters and the snowmobilers and things of that nature. And I'm telling you, it had a major impact on our supper. You know, guys would come in, have a beer, have a burger, have a fish fry. That just is not happening anymore, and it's falling off even farther every year as this goes forward. That's all I have to say. It's disappointing that what our legislators are doing in Madison regarding the deer hunt, everything from CWD to the explosion of doe tags here in Price County, which was ridiculous. But that's just my comment. So I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thank you so much, Mike. Dean, did you want to comment on Mike's comment?
Sure. I live in Vilas County, and I hunt over in Price and Ashland County, so I'm pretty familiar with the area that Mike's talking about. I don't know who he is, but I mean, I think it was last year I did a story after the deer season. I called around to a number of businesses, gas stations, sporting goods shops, bar grills, motels, and every one of them said that their business has dropped off noticeably. Now, a lot of them were, and probably rightfully so, blaming it on the electronic registration. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. And I know that deer numbers are doing pretty well in other areas of the state, and we're down to 4 buck-only units this year, buck-only counties, or part of one county, three full counties and part of one county. But there still are not a lot of deer in northern Wisconsin, and I think because of that, there are not a lot of hunters coming up here anymore, not as many as there used to be. So I think two things happening there. We have the electronic registration,
which is, so people aren't having to go anywhere to register a deer. And in the old days, if they did, they'd often stop in somewhere for a little while and have something to eat or something to drink and then go on their merry way. The deer numbers being down, it's not helping anything either. They have come back a little bit. I know we had a mild winter, but, man, I'll tell you what, we're still not seeing a lot of deer up north. And every place I call last fall, the owner said, man, they're just getting beat up bad with a lack of business.
Okay, well, thanks for weighing in on that, Dean. Now for another point of view, let's talk to Eric in Ringel. Eric, are you with us?
Hi, thanks for fielding my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to support the new tagging and registration procedures. I love the Go Wild system where I can purchase and print my own harvest authorizations and permits. I like it that you don't have to have gun cases or back tags anymore. The in-person registration, I'm glad that's gone. For turkey registration, you harvest a turkey early in the morning. I live in Marathon County, and typically you have to wait for a bar to open up at 10 or noon before you could register it, then butcher. It just makes it so much more convenient. Elderly, less physically capable hunters, if they don't have assistance like I experienced with my 84-year-old father, it was just tougher for him to get a deer out of the woods to a registration station and then back again, sometimes recurring and hanging up twice, hanging up and then wait till the station opens up, take it back down and haul it in. So I like the direction that DNR is going.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting us hear that, your opinion. Pat, you kind of agree with him?
I agree, but I also have mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. When we get back in the previous caller's experiences too, these are things that we have to decide as a society, and we have, it's very easy for us to talk about investing in companies and spending, just recently we're committing like $3 billion to Foxconn. And meanwhile, you think, well, there are investments we can make within the state with an existing operations that protect and grow jobs too. And the thing that I keep coming back to with all these different discussions is that, well, if you think the problems are bad right now with no deer in northern Wisconsin and not enough people coming to restaurants and convenience stores to register a deer and not bringing that kind of business in, I think what's going to happen as we keep ignoring CWD, keep ignoring its spread, keep ignoring all the problems that it's going to cause, and think how that's going to collapse that deer hunting industry in Wisconsin. Eventually, all these things that we're talking about will look like little bitty problems compared to the big problem I think that's coming down the road at us.
So we're looking at almost a perfect storm. I hate to say that, Tim. What do you think?
Well, I think we're losing a lot of our history and tradition, and that's why the registration stations, the tagging, which we're used to, and knowing then that they had the numbers and that tags were with the animals. This gentleman mentioned even about gun cases. I mean, I grew up believing that shotguns, rifles needed to be cased when you have them in the car, and the change of not having to case them to me is unwise, just the same as doing away with a back tag. So it's two different viewpoints, but I prefer what we had.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Jim in Lake Mills who wants to talk a little bit about CWD. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a hunter and a fisherman. I'm also a hiker, camper, bird watcher, and I really enjoy the outdoors. I'm a big fan of Wisconsin Outdoor News and your three guests. I read the publication pretty religiously. I live in the South, but I spend a lot of time in Price and Vilas counties especially, but in the North, I love it up there, and I own some property up in Price County. I really appreciate your comments and the articles you write about CWD and making that a focus, and some of the comments the callers have made as well. But one thing that pertains to that, I think, that doesn't get much attention is kind of an editorial policy at Wisconsin Outdoor News that kind of seems to support this current goal of 350 for the wolf population. This was established, a couple decades ago, set by the legislature, not the professionals. And it echoes a fear and loathing of wolves, especially in the North. And I understand that being from the South, I don't contend with wolves on a daily basis or have to worry about it. But I do hunt deer, and I've encountered wolves while hunting on my own land. But one thing I just want to bring up is that a higher wolf population could help address CWD because wolves harvest sick animals. And I'd like to see more attention given in general to that because I think the CWD, it's not only a risk to humans, it's also a risk to the dairy industry in our state. And I'd just like to know, hear your comments about that and wouldn't that be a way to allow a slightly higher wolf population, wouldn't that help with this problem?
Okay, Pat, do you want to take that?
Sure, I can start. I know Dean will have some thoughts too on
sure.
this. You know, personally, I've never favored this idea of rolling back down to 350 for a wolf goal. I mean, that's been the long-term goal, and some folks want to manage the wolf population down to that number, and I guess I still kind of side with the scientists at the UW that look at that number and think, you know, it provides a good cushion there where you don't have to risk getting that population so low where things might cause problems we can't foresee right now. So I think we should just kind of keep it up a little bit higher than that, you know, keep it around 600, whatever it might be, and provide the shock absorber. But this is one of these topics where we can argue all day about wolf populations, wolf estimates, and just talk ourselves in circles over it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I guess that's where I agree with the caller that I'm not a big favor of the 350 goal, but I can understand the people that want to get there. But I don't think it's going to happen right now. We're stuck in no man's land right now with the court rulings on this, and it'll be some time before we actually get back to having a real practical discussion about the whole issue.
And Jim's point on possibly having higher wolf population lowering CWD?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, that's one of the it's possible. I mean, there's some speculation and pretty interesting theories on that. But I don't know. To think that the rate we're at right now with CWD in southwestern Wisconsin and the way it's pushing outward, I have a hard time believing that the wolf population is going to alter that a whole lot, no matter how many wolves you get down there. And the fact is, too, you're not going to get wolf populations in the central part of the state and the southern part of the state to the number that you can have them up north. We just don't have the habitat, and I don't think we're going to have the tolerance of it. So to me, it's kind of it's an interesting topic, but I think it's kind of a pipe dream to think that we're going to have wolves turn the CWD situation around for us.
Okay, and Dean, what are your thoughts?
Let's see, it's 12:17. Cut down at 12:30, right?
12:28, actually.
a couple of areas here we could talk about a little bit. Let's go with the sick, lame, and lazy theory first. And that's, you know, that's what I call it. You know, you hear it all the time, and it does occur. Wolf, cougar, bear, whatever the predator might be, caught coyote. Sure, if there's three deer standing there and one of them is less healthy than the other, or three rabbits, the sick, lame, or lazy one is probably going to get clobbered. But if there's one healthy deer standing out in front of a wolf and a wolf is hungry, it's not going to pass it up and go look for a sick deer. It's going to kill and eat the live deer. And so, you know, the idea of getting wolves to kill only CWD-stricken deer in areas where we have CWD, probably not a viable idea, like Pat said. And the other part of it is we just don't have enough wolves in areas where CWD is the most prevalent to make a difference. I mean, you could have every bear, wolf, and coyote and cougar that might be in Richland County or Iowa County eating CWD deer, but it's not going to make a difference. We just don't have enough of that. Now, we have a lot of readers who have heard the same theory from folks who have the point of view of the caller about trying this avenue, and what they'd like to do is capture a lot of wolves from northern Wisconsin and bring them down to Iowa County and release them and see if it makes a difference, and then in their mind have some relief from wolves up here. As far as the 350 number, I've been around this topic a long time. I went to some of the first meetings in the 1980s where Dick Thiel was talking about Wisconsin having no more than 100 wolves, 80 to 100 wolves. Of course, we didn't know a lot about wolves, or they didn't know a lot about wolves at that point, and wolves are much more able to live in a wide variety of habitat than folks first imagined when they started appearing here more often in Wisconsin. Even if we had the population goal at 350, we'd never get down to that. We'd always have a cushion, because I just can't imagine that the DNR would issue permits at a level that would allow us to get the actual number of wolves in the 350 neighborhood. It's always, I would imagine, always going to be 600 to 1,000, no matter, you know, how many permits we issue, because in living up here, I feel I can say this, we have more wolves than what we've, you know, we have a minimum estimate. I've just made a major mistake. Minimum count. We don't estimate wolves. We have a count. We have a minimum count of about 1,000 wolves. So that's what we'd base our permit issuance on, is that number. We actually have more wolves than that. So if we issue tags based on having 1,000 wolves or counting 1,000 wolves, that's never going to get us down to a goal of 350, if that's where the goal ends up. That discussion still has to take place. So if you spend a lot of time on the subject, you'll know that there's really nothing to worry about. We're going to have plenty of wolves. There's not going to be a danger of ever getting down to the point where they leave Wisconsin or disappear from Wisconsin.
So it's complicated. Thanks so much.
You still have 7 minutes left yet.
Well, I think we did a pretty good job of covering that. I should say you did. Unless, Tim, you wanted to weigh in, or you're good. He's good. Okay. Well, Jim, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let's kind of change something a little bit. Let's talk to Tom in Rhinelander. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Hi. My question has to, and I'm a hunter also, although I don't hunt as much as I used to do, but my question has to do with deer and white cedar trees. I spend a lot of time in Upper Michigan where there's a small deer herd, and I see a lot of regeneration of white cedar, and I see almost none of it in northern Wisconsin. Now, I know people say the deer herd is small here now, but over my lifetime, it got awfully big, and I think it frankly got out of balance, and I would like to hear what the writers have to say about that. I'd also like to respond to Mr. Bortz's comment. I think he misunderstood what the last caller said. I don't think the last caller was saying that we could get wolves to eat only deer with CWD. I think the last caller was simply acknowledging one of the bases that I don't think anyone disputes of evolution, which is that predators and prey stay in balance, and that fitness is developed through evolution, and the weakest and sickest and slowest are statistically more likely to be killed. It doesn't mean that a wolf is going to leave a healthy deer to go find a sick deer, but if a wolf is chasing a small herd of deer and one of them has a broken leg and straggles, or is sick with wasting disease and straggles, that's the one that's going to be taken. So that said, I enjoy Mr. Bortz's writing, Mr. Durkin's writing. I haven't read The Third Gentleman, but I thank them all for being on the air, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Well, The Third Gentleman, why don't you go ahead and see what you think about the cedar issue.
Well, I think Tom is right, Jill, that basically white cedar, and especially and also white pine, they're like candy to deer, especially white cedar. So I think it's not unusual that when you have a high deer population, they're going to definitely make it known on the cedar trees there's going to be a browse line, and it's very difficult. And I know as a private landowner, we've put in some white cedars, and we fence them. So we put fencing around it, the best way to see it thrive. And we've had some that have gotten up quite tall, but anything that gets outside the cage, it's nibbled and it's not there any longer. So I think he's right.
It's the buffet. It's the buffet. Dean, did you want to put a comment on about that?
Sure. I own some land up in Ashland County, and for many years I was afraid to cut white cedar because I wasn't sure how to regenerate it. I never saw any new cedar, or not, I shouldn't say never, saw very little regeneration. And so I did a little bit of checking around with foresters and folks like that. And, you know, they said, you know, I said, geez, do I need fire? Do I need cut? You know, what does cutting work? Like, you know, cedar with popple. And they said, that's mostly browse. Well, in the last 10, 12 years, I have seen cedar regenerating on my land as deer numbers have gone down. So, you know, I would guess there was a time when Ashland County, the unit that I was in, used to be unit 28, when we were down around 4, 5, 6 deer per square mile over winter, then we saw cedar coming back. So, yeah, there is an impact of deer on cedar. But so now I'm not afraid to cut my cedar anymore. I know that if deer numbers are low enough, I can get cedar back. Okay. And I think the last caller is the last comment about the sick, lame, and lazy theory. I think we're both on the same page there. I think I said that if there are more than one animal together, that the weakest one would get clobbered. So I think we're pretty much on the same page there.
I think you were, too, as a, you know, bystander. I think you were. Okay, great. Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. And we have Adam in Black Earth with a question. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question. What's the process in getting a rule change as far as who to contact, especially something that's not a hot topic like CWD or wolves or something, just something simple as in like the bag limit on deer or on rabbit or squirrels? Do you go through the DNR, or do you go through your legislator, a warden, or what should you do?
Actually, Tim, that's probably right up your alley.
Well, being close to Black Earth, I'd be happy to try and help. But basically, the best way would be to contact the Conservation Congress. And there is a Conservation Congress representative in each county. And you can talk to them or take it to the spring hearings, which are normally in April. And that's where they take ideas. And people come up with ideas that they present that are then voted upon. And if they present an idea, and then basically it goes to the Congress and it goes to a study committee, they take a look at it, and maybe the following year it'll come back to the full Congress, and then it may come back statewide. It could be voted on statewide. So really, you want to talk probably to the Conservation Congress person in your county and get that in there. Realistically, right now, a lot of people go to their legislator, and that's unfortunately what's happening. But I'd say go to the Congress.
Okay, great. Hopefully that answers your question, Adam. Thank you so much for calling. And gentlemen, we're kind of rolling down here, but final word from each of you. Dean, why don't you start? What's top of your mind right now? Short, quickly.
Well, we have the gun deer season coming up here later in November, and I just want to wish everybody a safe and successful season. Even though I've struggled personally a little bit to have fun during the last few seasons because of some of the changes going on, it's still important to get out there and continue the tradition, do what you like to do, and include your friends and family in it. And I'll be doing that this year with my 10-year-old grandson.
Okay, thanks, Dean. Pat?
Yeah, the point I like to make to hunters, my fellow hunters, is that don't look to the DNR, don't look to the legislature for your fun. They are not in the business of providing your fun. It's still up to you. It's still up to you and your friends and your family. And that's what I look forward to. When I think about deer hunting, I think about getting together with the friends and family, chasing deer and looking for deer and just really enjoying the experience. And that's where you find your satisfaction is, you know, within your own network, not outside in the government.
Okay, thanks, Pat. Tim?
I just think it's so important that the future of hunting depends on our ethics and how we behave outdoors. Also, this weekend is going to be the opening of a new observation center at Goose Pond by the Madison Audubon Society. So, good place.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm Jill Nadeau sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks to Michelle Johnson and Dave Potras for technical direction. Stay with us. There's more to come.